Right then, this is now talk number 4 in the series that we're doing on how to become wise, which comes from my book 5. And we were in the middle of looking at the fool and what the fool does and so forth. So let's continue on that theme. So the fool has no regard for the concept of eternity. A fool rarely ever thinks about eternity, if at all, and he has no regard for the day of judgment. And therefore, if you don't currently spend much time considering eternity in general, and judgment in particular, it means that, at least in that regard, you're being foolish. And so, one way to become wiser is to force yourself to reflect on your own death, and on the judgment which will then follow as you enter into eternity. It's out of fashion doing that. People today don't like to think about death or talk about death. It's a taboo subject. But considering those momentous future events, your own death and what follows, will profoundly affect how you live now, and it will alter all your priorities. And so that is one of the best ways that we can grow in wisdom and rid ourselves of foolishness. Okay, next point. A fool is self-centered, and he automatically sees himself as being at the center of the universe, with all other people and all other situations orbiting around him. So a fool is always positioned at the center of his own universe. That's how he sees it. Now, it's actually difficult for any of us to avoid this mistake, not just fools. So obsession with yourself and focusing excessively or even exclusively on your own needs is the natural attitude of our old man, our flesh, which we all continue to have even after we're saved. And therefore, this tendency, this mistake, is deeply ingrained in all of us. And I used to train my staff in my law firm about this tendency to be self-centered, and I referred to it as having a wrong astronomy. And that means automatically assuming that we are at the center of the universe, and that clients, colleagues, bosses and so forth are all in orbit around us. You're seeing yourself at the center and everybody going around you. That's the way, the natural and normal way to see life and to see everything. But if we think that way, we will inevitably go wrong. Instead, we have to make a conscious decision to go against all of our ingrained fleshly instincts, and we need to start to see ourselves as being in orbit around whoever we're dealing with or working for, not to see them as being in orbit around us. So if we're a lawyer, the client is at the center, and we must always be on the periphery, in orbit around him. And if you're a nurse, the patient's needs should always be at the center, never your own needs. And that's how it should be. Now, that's easy enough to say as a slogan, but it's hard to do, and it's even harder to get your staff to do it. Now, my personal belief is that fewer than 10% of British people genuinely think that way about their jobs, or in fact about any part of their lives. Actually, it's probably fewer than 2%. But if you will force yourself to adopt this attitude, it'll have a knock-on effect on all of your actions, your decisions, your priorities. Everything changes when you realize that you are not even the center of your own workplace, let alone the entire universe. And if you keep on reminding yourself of your correct place, which must always be at the edge of any situation you're in, not the center, then you will be much, much better placed and much better off. Because that's the reality. You being at the center is just an imaginary thing that exists only in your imagination. Nobody else sees it that way. You are not in any case, meant to be at the centre of anything. And if that's where you think you are, then you have a wrong view of yourself and of the world. And I once interviewed a young woman, aged 22, and her name was Emily. And she'd just graduated in law, and she wanted to become a trainee solicitor, lawyer. Now, she did quite well in the interview, so I invited her in for an open-ended trial period working in our firm. Now, my policy was always to pay candidates who were given an opportunity like that a full daily wage if they were invited to have a short trial period with us. So they were paid in full, even though they never did anything of any value for us. They were just doing little tests and trials and being asked to do this and do that. But it took us more time to show them what to do and how to do it than any benefit we gained from it. Now, paying people like that is unusual. Most firms treat that as unpaid work experience and give the candidate nothing. So he's there working for nothing each day. Not me. I paid them in full. Now, the purpose of the trial was just for us to assess them. It wasn't for them to actually help us or do any useful work. Now, Emily did quite well on her first trial day, so I invited her to stick around and go on to a more extended trial period during which we could continue to review her each day. And after 4 days on trial, I said to her that she was still doing well and I was therefore going to extend her trial period, which is fully paid, for an even longer time. Now, this was all happening in the middle of a deep recession, especially in the legal profession, where jobs like that in law firms were really hard to get. Now, so therefore, I was giving her good news. I was saying you can stay around on full pay and keep on trial, see whether we want to keep you on permanently. But to my surprise, she began to cry. And she complained that she'd already been on trial for 4 days and that we ought to be able to decide by now. And then she said, it's not fair to keep her on trial. Now, I would have been amazed by that reaction in the past, but I've learned that it's a very common attitude. Now, her problem was that she was profoundly self-centred and also proud, and therefore it was intolerable to her that she'd not been accepted immediately. Now, the trial period was actually a privilege, but she could only see it as an imposition, as an irritant, which was delaying her in getting what she wanted. And her self-centeredness had never been challenged before by her parents or her teachers, and they'd therefore helped to make her into a fool. And I brought her trial period to a swift end, and I sent her home that day. So all she achieved was to bring about the end of her trial period. But she saw nothing wrong in what she'd said. Her focus was so entirely upon herself that she thought that she was being mistreated by having the trial prolonged, and that we'd wronged her by not approving of her immediately and appointing her to a permanent job, that we were letting her down or mistreating her. So, a fool is self-absorbed and is guided almost entirely by self-interest, not by duty or by the wish to act rightly. So that's our next heading. Now, when a fool is choosing what to do or how to react to a situation, self-interest will usually be his only guiding principle. And we see this at elections, where most people vote primarily or even solely on the basis of what they imagine to be best for themselves. And they have no regard for, and don't give any thought to, the question of what God wants, or what's best for their local community, or what's best for the nation. And such considerations rarely come into it. And therefore, few politicians today even bother appealing to our generosity or to our sense of civic duty, because they know that most of us are only interested in ourselves, and therefore they're realistic enough to focus on what interests us, and they carefully avoid telling us any home truths. And we can't really blame them in a sense. It's mainly our fault that they are so dishonest, not their fault. We are bigger fools than they are. They're just responding rationally and logically to the facts of what kind of an electorate we really are. Now, if our thinking is self-centered, we need first of all to acknowledge that fact and then take active steps to change it. So when we vote, we need to focus on what our duty and what that is, on what God wants. And we need to focus on what's inherently right and wrong, not just on what we think is best for ourselves. And the same applies to all areas of life and to all the choices we have to make in our work life or our family life, not just how we use our vote. But as with all the other changes that we need to make, it will not even begin to happen unless we force ourselves to think differently. So one of the features of this kind of self-absorption is that it makes you forgetful of others and of their needs. Instead, what we actually need is to be forgetful of ourselves and mindful of others. That's what we should be. And achieving that is part of what it means to die to self and to crucify the flesh, which the Bible commands us to do. And doing this, it helps us to wrench our attention away from ourselves and to apply it elsewhere, contrary to all of our own sinful habits and ways and priorities. Now that is one of the good things about pursuing the Great Commission, which Jesus instituted in Matthew chapter 28, verses 19 and 20, when he commanded us to make disciples of all nations. Now that's an order. And the point is that the process of doing that, as well as fulfilling Jesus' command, it helps us to redirect our focus away from ourselves and towards others, which is something that would never happen naturally, only by making it happen. Now the world's wisdom, which is actually just folly, so far as God is concerned, is all about looking after number one, putting yourself first, making sure that you're okay. Now, approaching life in that way, which is what the unsaved world and far too much of the church does, will only cause you to become more and more self-absorbed and therefore more and more of a fool. But obeying Jesus' words and applying yourself to the task of making disciples will help to cure you of that self-centeredness. It will recalibrate you until focusing on other people, on their lostness, on their need to be saved, on their need to be discipled, begins to become normal for you and even becomes your preference. And it requires a complete recalibrating of your mind, being transformed by the renewing of your mind, as Paul puts it. Okay, well, the next point. God commands us not to waste our time with fools, because if we do, we will only become like them. So there are a number of reasons why we're told not to associate with fools. Firstly, you cannot learn much from a fool, except by noting his bad habits and his bad attitudes and seeking to avoid them in yourself. Apart from that, he has very little to offer you. But he's not going to learn from you either, because he has no desire to learn from you. So you can't even help him by associating with him. But secondly, whatever group we currently belong to, we will inevitably become like the people with whom we spend most of our time. So whatever group we may be in, whatever group they may be, we will move in their direction. And that's why it's so important to put yourself in the right group and hang about with the right people. Now that law applies just the same if we spend time with fools as it does with spending time with wise people or any other type of person. You hang around with the wicked, you become wicked. You hang around with fools, you become a fool. Hang around with the wise, you'll become wise. You see? It's simply a law of the universe. It's simply a fact. It's simply true. It's what happens. So let's look at a few verses that bear this out. And of course I could give many more, that give us this advice, telling us who to be with, who to knock about with. Proverbs 13:20. He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm. And remember who wrote that? King Solomon. He knows a thing or two. Now Proverbs 22, verses 24 to 25. Do not associate with a man given to anger, or go with a hot-tempered man, or you will learn his ways and find a snare for yourself. And then 1 Corinthians 15:33, Apostle Paul says this, do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. Okay? And then Proverbs 14:7 says, leave the presence of a fool, for there you do not meet words of knowledge. And Proverbs 24:1 says, be not envious of evil men, nor desire to be with them. Okay? Proverbs 24:21-22. My son, fear the Lord and the king, and do not join with those who do otherwise, for disaster will arise suddenly from them, and who knows the ruin that will come from them both. You see? So, I mean, I could have given more, but I think it's beyond dispute. The Bible is telling us that we need to be careful who we spend our time with. But how many of us have ever sat down and thought, I need to be careful who I spend my time with? I need to make wise choices about this. Okay? Now, if a fool was to spend a lot of time with wise men, then, over a period of time, even he would change and become wiser. But the problem is that rarely happens, because fools don't want to be with wise people, and they try very hard to avoid being with them. Now, wise people make fools feel uncomfortable just by being there, even if they say nothing to rebuke them. You see, the presence of a wise person in a room, the very life of that wise man is a rebuke. Just his life is a rebuke, even if he doesn't say anything. And so, you will never become wise unless you are willing to be made to feel uncomfortable, at least for a time, by being with people who are wiser and godlier and more knowledgeable than you. If you're not willing to experience that uncomfortableness, how can you progress? The process of being influenced by those people and changing for the better will always feel difficult while it's happening. And also, the benefit only becomes apparent later on, which is another reason why it doesn't appeal to fools, because it doesn't seem to be helping them right there and then, at that moment. Therefore, a wise man will not usually be able to influence a fool. If he engages him in a meaningful conversation about anything that really matters, the fool will usually only despise what is said to him, and he won't listen to it. So, the Bible says in Proverbs 23:9, do not speak in the hearing of a fool, for he will despise the wisdom of your words. Despise meaning not value. It doesn't mean hate. He won't give any value to the wisdom that you have. So therefore, if you aren't yet a fully developed fool, and you don't want to become one, then avoid spending time with fools. And likewise, if you're behaving foolishly in some ways already, and you don't want to continue doing so, or to get even worse or more foolish, then keep away from other fools. Avoid their influence. Break off your contact with them. Now, of course, there are some people with whom we have no choice but to be with them. They might be our neighbours or our work colleagues or even family members, and therefore contact with them can't be avoided. Realistically speaking, you can't avoid being with your work colleagues and so forth. But those are not the people that we're being told to avoid. The Bible is referring to the voluntary choices that we make as to whom we spend our time with. Now, God only wants us to associate, where possible, where practicable, with those who are likely to be a good influence on us, or the people with whom we can realistically hope to influence for good. Because sometimes it's the wise man who's willing to spend time with the naive man, do you see? Knowing that he could possibly help him. So in this next pair of linked verses from Proverbs, I wanted to point this out. We're given advice that sounds like a contradiction, but actually it's not. Now, verse 4 here, Proverbs 26 verse 4, it says, "Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself." But then immediately afterwards, verse 5 says, "Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes." So it sounds like a contradiction, but this is a biblical technique where you state the same thing twice in a slightly different way. It's a literary technique that the Bible uses, and it's not a contradiction. The two verses go together, and what they mean really is this. Firstly, it means, do not sink to the same level as a fool by answering him in the same foolish, carnal, scoffing, bad-tempered, inflammatory manner in which he speaks to you. Now, if you do that, you will just become like him. But at the same time, it's saying, do answer him in the way that he deserves, because of his being a fool. That means by sidestepping him, ignoring him. Don't waste any time trying to influence or educate a fool. Just avoid him and spend your time with wise or simple people instead, as far as you practically and reasonably can. Let me move on to another issue now. Alcohol, tobacco and drugs. It is both foolish and sinful to drink alcohol excessively, to smoke tobacco and to take drugs, by which I mean illegal drugs. I don't mean paracetamol. So, contrary to many denominational traditions, it is not a sin to drink alcohol. Alcohol in itself is not an evil thing, and we are free to drink it. The Bible makes that absolutely clear. Now, admittedly, some people in the Bible are told not to drink, and also told not to do various other things either. But the rest of us are never forbidden to drink alcohol. As such, we are only forbidden to get drunk. And I want to go into this in a little bit of detail, because it's an area of deep confusion to people in churches, about which I think there is inadequate teaching. And therefore people just pick up a thread of something, a particular verse, and they make that into their whole doctrine. Okay, so there are some things that particular people are commanded not to do, but let's take for example the Nazarite vow. All right, a small minority of Jews took this vow, and John the Baptist is probably the most famous example of this. Now, those who took this vow, they separated themselves to the Lord, and as part of that, they separated themselves from wine and strong drink. But also, this is important, they separated themselves even from the very grapes, or even the seeds that came out of the grapes, all right? Now, let's look at Numbers 6, 1 to 4. It says, "And the Lord said to Moses, say to the people of Israel, when either a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to separate himself to the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar made from wine or strong drink, and shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes, fresh or dried." So he can't even have currants or anything, raisins or anything. "All the days of his separation, he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins." Okay? Now that's a very clear, comprehensive, all-encompassing prohibition of having anything to do with grapes or anything to do with them. Okay? Now therefore, those who took this vow, whom we refer to as Nazarites, they were the exception, not the norm. Can you see it says, when either a man or a woman makes a special vow. Well, how can it be a special vow if it's for everyone to make? It's for the Nazarites to make. John the Baptist was not your average, ordinary man. He was a special, special case, you see. So those people who took the Nazarite vow were not the norm. And I stress that fact because some people, using a passage like that, they use it to oppose alcohol in and of itself. And they refer to the command that was given to the Nazarites as if it applied to all of us, when it plainly doesn't. It only applies to those people who are called by God to that very special ministry, which was always, only ever, a small minority. But also, note how in that passage I've just read from, both wine and strong drink are referred to, but also the very grapes themselves and their juice and even their seeds. So you can't have grapes, you can't have grape juice, you can't have grape seeds, you can't have skins, you can't have currants, raisins, you can't have any of that. Now, if therefore God intended the Nazarite vow to apply to all of us, which he clearly doesn't, then we would all be forbidden to drink grape juice either, or even to eat grapes or currants or anything. But the point is that those people who wish to abolish alcohol and who tell us that God forbids its consumption, they never go on to say that we can't drink grape juice or eat grapes. Indeed, they insist that we have grape juice at communion so that we don't have any wine. But grape juice is forbidden by Numbers chapter 6. Do you see? It's equally forbidden. So they don't do it. They don't forbid grape juice or the eating of grapes because they know that would be ridiculous. And they know deep in their hearts that the Bible makes no such command. So they're misusing scripture. They're twisting scripture. And they also know deep down, as we all know, that wine means wine, grape juice means grape juice. You know, that these are two different things, totally different things. Now, the very fact that God refers to both of these things in the above passage proves that wine and grape juice are not the same thing. Because if wine and grape juice were the same thing, he'd only say it once, wouldn't he? You see? And it proves that when God refers to wine, he means wine. That means fermented alcoholic wine, not grape juice. Now, this is part of my special ministry of stating the downright obvious, but I have to stress that point because there are many people who point to passages in the Bible where godly characters drink wine, including the prophets and apostles and even Jesus himself, and they explain it away by saying that what they were all actually drinking was unfermented non-alcoholic grape juice. But as we see, those are two different things, and God does not confuse the two words in the Bible. He doesn't mix up grapes and grape juice and wine, and he doesn't get them muddled up. He distinguishes them. Therefore, although wine and everything else associated with the grape, plus various other things such as cutting their hair, were forbidden to the Nazarites, they are not forbidden to the rest of us. Now, the thing is, if you wanted to take this kind of thinking to its logical conclusion, and you want to ban alcohol, then why aren't you banning the cutting of hair? Why aren't you campaigning for the closing of all hairdressers and barbers? Do you see? Because it equally follows. Now, perhaps the most compelling proof of that point that I just made is that Jesus himself produced wine for the wedding at Cana. And again, it's often said, well, he produced grape juice, but it was not mere non-alcoholic grape juice, as some people claim. It was real wine. Now, if wine was forbidden to us, why would God himself speak favourably of it? Why would Jesus have made it? And why would God cause the ground, the earth, to provide it to us, as he speaks of in these verses? So here's a couple of verses from Psalm 104, verse 14 to 15, okay? It says, "You cause the grass to grow for the livestock, and plants for man to cultivate, that he may bring forth food from the earth, and wine to gladden the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread to strengthen man's heart." Okay? See that? It talks about wine to gladden the heart of man. Now, how can a person's heart be gladdened by drinking unfermented grape juice? If ever you've had unfermented grape juice, it's perfectly nice stuff, but you don't come away from it with your heart gladdened or feeling merry or, you know, unable to drive a motor car, do you? You don't have that feeling. And it's ridiculous to suggest, as so many people do, that that is what is meant. And if you take that approach, why not also suggest that the verses which refer to bread or olive oil are not referring to real bread or real olive oil? So why would you single out wine and say, oh, that doesn't mean real wine, that means grape juice? But then in the immediate next line, when it talks about bread and oil, oh no, that means bread and oil. But this is where it says wine, it means grape juice. But oil means olive oil and bread means bread. Why not say that bread means something else and oil means something else? And of course, people don't say that because it would be silly. So why single out wine on its own when making this claim that wine is prohibited? And also, if wine is grape juice, why would we be told in the Bible not to get drunk on wine if wine is just unfermented grape juice? Because it wouldn't be possible to do it, would it? Because you could drink 2 gallons of grape juice, might make yourself sick, but you wouldn't get drunk. You could drink grape juice all day long, you would never get drunk on it. So why would God command us not to get drunk on grape juice? Why would God go to the trouble of commanding you not to do something which you cannot do? Do you see? So you cannot have it both ways and interpret the meaning of the word wine differently according to whatever suits your argument at any given time. And the suggestion that God means non-alcoholic wine is absurd. The only limitation which the Bible puts upon us is that our drinking should not be excessive. In other words, we must not get drunk. So moderate, sensible, responsible drinking of alcohol is fine and does not involve any sin at all. And we mustn't create sins that aren't in the Bible. We mustn't make things into sins because it would suit our purposes or it suits our argument. You see? Okay, so although drinking alcohol is not a sin, drunkenness is a sin and we must avoid it. Now I'm switching around. You might think I'm some kind of campaigner for the drinks industry and I've got shares in vineyards and things. I haven't. I'm just trying to interpret the Bible faithfully. So, having said all of that, the fact is that getting drunk is a sin in itself, even if it does not lead to other things such as violence or promiscuity. So that the main reason why God forbids drunkenness, as opposed to him forbidding us to engage in any drinking at all, even when it's done moderately, is that when a person is drunk, this is the point, they lose some or all of their self-control. Okay, have you ever thought this through? That's what it's about. So the reason drunkenness is prohibited is because you lose self-control. And self-control is one of the fruits of the Holy Spirit, which we are commanded to cultivate. Well, drinking takes it away, okay? Drinking to excess takes it away. Therefore, the person becomes vulnerable and is at increased risk from their own sin nature, which, while they are drunk, has far greater power over them. And that's because their mind, and especially their will, cease to function as effectively as they should. So if you remember my analogy of the committee table, when you become drunk, the seating arrangement is changed on the committee table. The microphone is passed over to the old man, and he now gets the microphone in front of him. And the mind and the will, the microphone is moved down the table, away from the mind and the will, and is right in front of the old man, the flesh. And that's what drunkenness does. So the will, basically, begins to lose control of the committee. Can you picture that? You've got a committee, but it's getting out of hand. Do you see? You started off with a good chairman, he's in control, but now he's losing it. Why? Because drunkenness puts the microphone in front of the old man, the flesh. He now begins to speak for you. He now begins to make decisions for you instead of the will. Does that make sense? Now, I hasten to add, none of what I'm saying is in the Bible. It's just my analogy, helping to explain how we lose control in a situation. Okay. So, when we get drunk, we are at increased risk from our own sin nature, which, while a person is drunk, has far greater power over them. And that's because the mind and will cease to function properly. Therefore, quite foreseeably, a person who is drunk is likely to do or say things to others or allow things to be done to them which would never have happened if they had not been drunk. Now, what I'm saying is surely a statement of the blindingly obvious, isn't it? We see the evidence for it all around us. Drunken people often behave appallingly, and they destroy many lives, including their own and the lives of their families. And this arises directly or indirectly through the effects of their drunkenness, either on themselves or their families or on their others or work colleagues or anyone else with whom they come into contact, even other motorists. And therefore, the Bible warns us against drunkenness, not drinking. Okay? We must not take the two words, drunkenness and drinking, and make them the same word. They're not the same word. Okay, so drunkenness is forbidden. Let's look at a few verses. Proverbs 20, verse 1. Wine is a mocker, strong drink a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise. Now, what does being led astray by it mean? It means letting it take control, letting it rule over you. Wine must always be your servant, never your master. It must never have control over you. And if you're led astray by drink, it will always lead you in the wrong way. If wine is in control, if drink is in control, it will always take you the wrong way, into wrong things. You must be in control of it. And you must above all be in control of yourself. You decide how much you will drink and when you will stop and say, that's enough, I've had enough. Do you see? Now this verse, Proverbs 21, actually reminds me. When I was a probationary police officer, I had to write a project, and I chose to write a project on theft. And I wrote it on theft, but I used that verse, Proverbs 21, as one of the introductory passages in my report. I got into trouble with the chief inspector for putting the Bible in my project. He didn't like that. And yet, although he didn't like it, I actually got a commendation from the chief constable for my project. But the chief inspector in my own station told me off. So I got both a rebuke and a commendation for the same thing. But anyway, I put it in my project. I went to interview a man. His name was Keith. And he had stolen a bottle of whiskey from a supermarket. And I had had to arrest him. He'd been detained by store detectives, and I arrested him, and I felt quite a lot of compassion towards him. He was a school teacher, an English teacher, and he was a complete alcoholic. That's the secular word for it. A drunkard is the biblical word for it. And he had a real, real drink problem. And afterwards, after I'd arrested him and got him sentenced and prosecuted, I went to visit him at his home to talk to him and interview him for my project. And he was quite happy to cooperate. And he became quite a major part of my project. And he had got into thieving like that, even as a school teacher. And that's what alcohol did to him, because he lost his control over himself. Ended up losing his job. He got convicted. He ended up being arrested by me. And that's what alcohol, when taken to excess, did to him. Do you see? And I'll never forget him. And then Proverbs 23:20-21, it says, "Be not among drunkards." Okay, don't even sit amongst them. "Or among gluttonous eaters of meat. For the drunkard and the glutton will come to poverty, and slumber will clothe them with rags." So what's it saying? This is advice being given by King Solomon, okay? It's a general rule. It's not an absolute law. It's a general rule. So don't be among drunkards. Because it's saying the drunkard and the glutton will come to poverty, and slumber, being lazy, will clothe them with rags. So drunkenness, gluttony, laziness will lead to poverty. That's what it's saying as a general rule. Okay? Solomon does not claim that these things are absolutely always the case, but they are generally the case. And we can see that with our own eyes, can't we? Alright, well, Isaiah 5:11-12 says, "Woe to those who rise early in the morning, that they may run after strong drink, who tarry late into the evening till wine inflames them. They have lyre and harp, timbrel and flute, and wine at their feasts, but they do not regard the deeds of the Lord or see the work of his hands." Now what's happening here is, Isaiah is speaking about people who are, for whom drink is in control. Drink is becoming a central part of their lives. They run after it, rather than simply make use of it at appropriate times in appropriate ways. Okay? Then when they do that, they are not regarding the deeds of the Lord or seeing the work of God's hands. They are being taken away from what they should be doing and seeing and focusing upon, and drink is taking over their lives. Okay, Romans 13, verse 13 to 14, it says, "Let us conduct ourselves becomingly, as in the day, not in reveling and drunkenness, not in debauchery and licentiousness, not in quarreling and jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires." So what Paul is speaking of here is, act like it's the day, do you see? And the night, he speaks of how the night is the province, the place for these wrong things. And so we need, I often say to people, get into UK time, get into the daytime, live your life in the daylight and be asleep at night. If you're awake all night and asleep in the day, you will be led into these things, reveling and drunkenness, debauchery, licentiousness. Licentiousness means living, having license to do whatever you want. Okay? What time of day you are awake at and what time of day you are asleep at will have a major bearing on the way you live your life. So live in the daylight, literally as well as metaphorically. So that's not just a metaphor. It's a literal statement. Live in the daylight, sleep in the night time. That the night is really a place that tempts you towards evil. Most of the wicked things in the world happen at night. It's not an absolute. Of course, some people have got to be awake at night, ambulance drivers and so forth. We're talking generally. Now, Galatians 5:19-21, it says, "Now the works of the flesh," that's the old man, "are plain: fornication, impurity, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery," that's witchcraft, "enmity, strife, jealousy, anger, selfishness, dissension," that's falling out with people, making cliques, "party spirit, envy, drunkenness, carousing," that's sexual impurity and immorality, "and the like. I warn you, as I warned you before, that those who do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God." Now, in amongst that group of things is drunkenness. Now, we cannot therefore claim that drunkenness is okay. Now, I've just spent quite a bit of time saying that drinking is not sinful. But now I'm spending time saying that drunkenness is sinful. Not only sinful, but dangerous and reckless. Now, you think, oh, there you are, you see, you're a highly confused Bible teacher. You're just not consistent with yourself. I am consistent with myself, provided you know there's a difference between the meaning of the word drinking and drunkenness. Do you see? Drink and drunk aren't the same thing. They're not the same thing. Alright. So, we have very clear biblical commands not to get drunk. And the wisdom of that is corroborated by the evidence of our own eyes as to what happens to people when they do get drunk. And therefore, we need to make sure that we never get drunk. And if we do, we get drunk, we are effectively abdicating our responsibility for maintaining our control of ourselves, and we're allowing it to be taken away from us. That's the first part of the sin and the reason why it's wrong. So indeed, much of the time, people positively want to lose their inhibitions. That's why they get drunk, because they want to cast off restraint. They want to feel more extrovert. They want to feel more courageous to go and make propositions to women, and they want that. They want to lose their inhibitions. They see that as a negative alternative word for self-control. So inhibitions, self-control, they want to lose that. Now the Bible commends the phrase self-control and sees it as a good thing. But they turn it round and call it inhibition. Do you see? It's not inhibition. So the fact that you don't act with sexual immorality is not inhibition. It's self-control, and it's a good thing. And you should not cast it off. You should not get rid of it. And you shouldn't do anything to make it go away or reduce it. And therefore, they get people who want to cast off restraint, who want to lose their inhibitions, and as they would put it, grow in confidence and feel more extrovert at a party and so on, that kind of thing. They get drunk deliberately to help themselves to cast off restraint and to do things, including sinful things, which they would never do otherwise. And therefore, from God's perspective, to deliberately drink alcohol to the extent that we lose some or all of our self-control is a serious sin in itself, even if you don't go on and do anything. It's like tampering with the brakes and steering of your car, thereby reducing or removing your ability to control it or stop it, but then getting into the car and driving it on the road. Now, everyone would see that that is an act of great recklessness. You would say that man's insane. He's just gone and half cut through his brake pipes and now he's driving his car. You'd say that's reckless and even wicked, given the obvious potential that your car has got to injure people, including yourself, but above all, others. Now, in the same way, doing anything to deliberately reduce your own restraints, your own self-control, and knowingly rendering yourself more likely to sin, or more likely to sin in more serious ways, is a sinful act in itself, even if you don't go on to sin. What I'm saying is, cutting your own brake pipes is a sin, even if your brake pipes don't fail and you don't crash your car. Just cutting your brake pipes is wrong, even if nothing comes of it. Do you see what I'm saying? And it would still be wrong, even if it was not your express intention for it to result in any harm. Because merely to expose yourself and others to an increased risk that such things might occur is sinful in itself. So, weakening the brake pipes on your car doesn't guarantee that an accident will happen. But it does foreseeably increase the chances of it happening. And the point is that to take an additional risk is blameworthy in itself. Firstly, you have no right to take risks with other people's lives. But secondly, you don't even have the right to take risks with your own life. Have you ever considered this? Neither do you have any right to take risks with your own propensity to sin, because you do not own yourself. You and your body belong to God. You are only a steward of His property. You are not the owner. You're not the owner even of your own body. He owns everything. He makes it very clear, and I deal with this in my other books in some detail as to why I say that. So you cannot therefore tell him that what you do with your own body is exclusively your own affair, even if you could be certain, which you can't be, that nobody else would ever be harmed by your drinking. Now the point is that God owns you and your body, and he's fully entitled to tell you what you can and cannot do with it. Now that fact alone is conclusive, quite apart from the additional point that drunkenness also increases the chances of your sinning against him in lots of other ways, as well as by reducing your self-control in all areas. So it's not only the sin of losing your self-control, it's the other sins that foreseeably are quite likely to follow on when you lose that control. Now, I'm warning against the danger and the sinfulness of drunkenness because it's on the increase. It's at least in the UK. Amongst older people, especially those in professional jobs or even from educated, wealthier backgrounds, a high proportion of them are now quietly sitting at home most evenings, drinking themselves into a kind of numb forgetfulness. They're also drinking to calm their nerves or to mask their unhappiness or to reduce the dullness of their lives. And that's not the right reason. But amongst young people, drunkenness is occurring more publicly as they go out drinking in public into the small hours, including engaging in drinking games, you know, not just having a drink, but drinking games. Now many of them, they drink cheap vodka from the supermarket even before they go out, so that they can be already drunk but achieve that drunkenness less expensively. So it's the desired objective, it's their aim to get drunk, but they know it's expensive to get drunk in a pub, so they get drunk on vodka from a supermarket before they go out and then go out for a drink, so it's less expensive, and they think that's quite a good idea, they think it's quite sensible. But their excessive drinking not only results in sin and violence and promiscuity, but it also results in serious damage to their own health. And doctors are reporting today that many people in their 20s or 30s now have the kind of unhealthy livers that were previously associated with people in their 70s. So there are many people in their 20s, late 20s, going around with a liver that is the liver of a 70-year-old. Do you see? Now, Isaiah has something to say to those who turn drinking into a contest or a game. It says, Isaiah 5:22 says, "Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink." It's not something to be, you know, a macho man about. Yesterday I was watching a football match. It was the championship playoffs. And I was listening to a man, right? I don't know whether he was making it up, but this is what he was boasting to his colleague next to me. He's sitting at the table next to me. I was overhearing. And he was saying that he could drink 25 pints. Right? 25. He used to be able to drink 25 pints, but now he could only drink 20 pints. You see? And this is what he was saying. Now he was saying this to brag, to boast, and he saw this as something that made him into a real man. Do you see? And it's just ludicrous. And my son was sitting next to me and pointed to this chap's stomach and he said look what he's doing, look what that 25 pints is doing, you see. And he had this great big belly on him. But he thought this made him a real man. And it was almost like a modern parable. He didn't see anything wrong in that. He thought that we'd all be impressed. He said that to impress the people who were listening. Alright? But anyway, it's not only a person's health which will be damaged by drunkenness. There is a clear pattern that drunkards also tend to end up in poverty for all sorts of direct and indirect reasons. Not all of them, but many of them. And it says in Proverbs 21:17, "He who loves pleasure will be a poor man. He who loves wine and oil will not be rich." Okay? Now, pleasure and wine and oil are fine, they're good things, they're to be had. But if you love them, if you love wine in the sense of living for it, thinking of it, focusing on it, giving too much of your time and energy and thought and money to it. I mean, I privately set a little sort of financial limit to how much I'm willing to pay for wine. You see wine being sold at all these prices, and I just won't pay more than a certain price for wine, because I think it's ridiculous to pay these high prices for wine. But there are many people who make it into a kind of almost an idol. But not only paying too much for it, but having too much of it, and having it too often, and living for it. Okay? And it will result in poverty if we do that, or very probably will. Right. Okay. What I'll do, I've got some more things to say about alcohol, tobacco, illegal drugs, and alcohol, and how to drink sensibly. What I'll do, I'll leave those to the next talk, and I'm going to stop at that point, and we'll carry on and finish the alcohol and drug point next time. So that's all on that talk.